Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress and a columnist for the American Prospect. With me is my good friend Meir Javed Anfar. Meir is a lecturer in Iranian affairs at the Interdisciplinary Center at Herzliya in Israel. He's also a contributor to Al Monitor and blogs at Iran Israel Observer. And you can also follow him on Twitter. He's a very active tweeter and one of my favorites. How you doing, Meir?
Thank you very much, Matt. It's great to be speaking with you.
So we saw yet again the ability of politics in the Middle East to surprise everyone with Iran's presidential elections last Friday. The winner was the most moderate candidate, and we have to be, I guess, careful here. He is a moderate relative to the others who were running, but I do think it's important and you know, very much worth noting that Iranian voters rallied once again behind the most moderate choice. What are your thoughts here?
First of all, it was a complete surprise because based on the 2009 elections, or the way some people say selections, the cheatings in what happened, the cheatings that took place, it was expected by many, including myself, that, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei has just had 8 years of Ahmadinejad. 4 years of those final years were lots of confrontations, lots of problems. That he's now going to want to have, you know, at least 4 years of peace and quiet, so he can focus on the nuclear program and all the issues that there are. So he's going to choose either yes man, which was going to be Jalili, or somebody from within the Revolutionary Guard, such as Kalibaf, who is more independent yet follows, you know, generally the same lines regarding many of the issues. But, you know, we didn't expect that, you know, there would actually be elections and somebody like Rouhani would get in, because, you know, Rouhani's ideas, whether his line was very much against what the Supreme Leader's supporter Jalili was talking about. So we thought, you know, the impression was, the assumption was, he's actually speaking to the opposite of what some of the lines seem to be in Iran, what the narrative is. So there's no chance that he's going to be elected, because not only he speaks in a different narrative, but also electing him, or being allowing him to be elected, which is what happened, is going to create even more friction, because, you know, Mr. Rouhani is associated with Mr. Khatami and Mr. Rafsanjani, and his supporters don't get along with the IRGC. So, you know, it wasn't going to be Rouhani. The assumption was Ayatollah Khamenei is looking to consolidate, but it turned out that no, it was Rouhani. He was elected by the people, and it shows, I think, more than anything, from people's level. Well, we've known that people of Iran have wanted change in many ways, but I think it could also send us a signal that there may be changes at the top.
So would you, do you, I mean, there's been a lot of talk, when people talk about Iran, it's often mentioned that, you know, the Supreme Leader is still very much in charge, and he's, and things really don't happen without his assent. Would you see the election of Rouhani as a defeat for the Supreme Leader?
I see the election of Rouhani as a defeat for the Supreme Leader's nuclear policies. If the Supreme Leader wanted to falsify elections like in 2009, he has the power to do it, and he could have done it. We saw even, you know, he could have just not allowed Rouhani to run. You know, we saw we did it with Rafsanjani, we did it with Mashai. Just didn't allow them to, you know, don't allow him to run. Just keep it a close contest, and that's it. You know, between conservatives or somebody from the moderates who would not be popular with the people of Iran. But he didn't let that happen. You know, he allowed Rouhani just not just to run, but also to win. And I think one of the assumptions that we can make is that I think the Supreme Leader is looking for improvement in relations with the West, and quite possibly the normalization of Iran's file at the IAEA, because, well, basically, you know, the things are becoming very difficult to manage inside Iran's economy.
I mean, there's a couple questions in there that I have. One, so you do think that the sign that Rouhani was allowed to run and win is a sign that the Supreme Leader is interested in better relations with the West?
I think it's becoming more obvious that he's... reluctantly so, he's being pulled towards that direction, yes.
So do you think that, you know, looking at international pressure, and it's clear, I think, from things that Rouhani has written about the way that the nuclear file was managed, because he was a former nuclear head nuclear negotiator himself, in the Hatemi era. He's been very critical of the way those negotiations were managed over the past few years, especially, you know, the referral of Iran to the UN Security Council and subsequent international actions, sanctions, other forms of pressure. What's your take on the role that international pressure may have played in this election, if any? I mean, I want to be careful here. I mean, we have a tendency, especially we Americans, to overestimate the impact that we make on other people's politics. But what's your sense of the role that international pressure played here?
I think inadvertently the sanctions could have played a role here. We were told by some groups that, you know, the sanctions have actually solidified the narrative around the Supreme Leader. They have strengthened the narrative of resistance around the Supreme Leader. Mm-hmm. That the only narrative that's being heard around the Supreme Leader is one of resistance and taking a more belligerent line towards the West, because the sanctions are leaving him only that option. But when we saw the election debates, if anything, there's a lot of divisions at the very top near the Supreme Leader. We saw Mr. Ali Akbar Velayati, who is the Supreme Leader's foreign policy advisor, completely taking on and disagreeing with Said Jalili's narrative regarding the nuclear program and his policies. And of course, we have to remember that Jalili is the Supreme Leader's nuclear negotiator. There was clear division very much at the top. And I think now we see that there's not just division, but there's also the question of the economy. You know, the Iranian economy is in very bad shape. I mean, we saw there's a recent Reuters report that the oil, I saw 700,000 barrels, the number being stated as the export now, which is, you know, which is a major drop. To Iran was exporting 2.5 million barrels. Again, I have to revise that number, but I think the number I saw was like 700,000. Barrels a day. And we also have the Iranian government has been borrowing money from the banks. Mr. Rafsanjani, you know, after he was not disqualified by the Guardian Council, he quoted a number which he was told by, I believe, one of the people from Iran's central bank, that he said that Iran, the government of Iran currently owes its contractors and its banks somewhere in the region of $240 to $250 billion. Hmm. I mean, if you put that into context, one of the numbers that you hear about in terms of the damage caused to Iran's economy during the Iran-Iraq war was $500 billion. So Iran is going almost through the same process. The damage it's suffering is staggering, and you know, it's very logical that you would want to address the situation, because, you know, despite some politicians who tell us that, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei is a messianic and he just dreams about blowing himself up for the sake of Palestinians, it's not like that. He wants his regime to survive. He wants his regime to prosper so he can also enrich his own wealth. Mm. And I think Mr. Rouhani now is going to be a very useful pathway, or if you want to say a useful tool for the Supreme Leader,
yeah,
as a means in order to save Iran's economy by reaching some kind of understanding with the West. And if I could just add one point, we have to be clear, Iran is not going to stop enrichment. Mm-hmm. The idea that Iran is going to zero enrichment, it's over.
Yeah.
We in the West have to realize it. Iran deserves that right. Iran needs nuclear energy. There's no doubt about it. But it seems that in Iran, they've also, the Supreme Leader may have realized that the idea that they just can continue with the status quo and to defy the West especially, it's no longer economically viable.
Right. Well, the criticism we're hearing from especially some hawks in the U.S. and in Israel is the sense that, you know, oh, great, now we have a more moderate face on the Iranian government. This just gives the Iranians an opportunity to continue moving toward a nuclear weapon and fooling everyone with the idea that their intentions are not sinister.
Yes, this is what we heard from Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday, that the world shouldn't believe just those nice words. Well, you know, to be honest with you, for the last 8 years in Israel, we were told by Mr. Netanyahu that Mr. Ahmadinejad is the almighty, all-powerful right. man in Iran who's got control over Iran's economy. Iran's nuclear program is a messianic, and if one day he gets the bomb, he's going to drop it on Israel. And mm-hmm. now all of a sudden, miraculously, overnight, Mr. Netanyahu, now that Rouhani is in power, he has decided that, no, the president is not strong enough. Excuse me, as we say in Hebrew, makara, what happened? Overnight, you change your mind like this? I think this is all part of the pressure strategy, which, of course, you know, nobody wants the Iranian regime to have nuclear weapon, but it's exaggeration in a way that is hurting Israel's very legitimate concerns regarding Iran's nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Mr. Netanyahu should have taken a leaf out of President Peres' book and actually congratulate the people of Iran on the recent elections. It goes to show that people of Iran want moderation. People of Iran want to have a nuclear energy for civilian purposes and an economy. They voted against extremism. And I don't think, you know, just because Rouhani is going to be speaking in a reconciliatory manner, it's going to be, everybody's going to say, oh, it's okay, you can just, you know, keep ignoring the IAEA. It's not going to happen. 8 years of Ahmadinejad as president has built such a wide-ranging consensus against Iran's nuclear program that I think, you know, it's not going to fall apart just because Mr. Rouhani, who is a moderate, is going to speak a language of reconciliation or rapprochement. Iran is going to be judged by its actions, especially in regards to the IAEA.
Getting back to Netanyahu's response, I mean, I see your point there with regard to things he could have said, but in a way, it almost seems like that would have been the worst thing for Rouhani, is to have Netanyahu come out and say, oh, great, he was elected. I mean, the way, you know, this way you have Peres making a more conciliatory statement and Netanyahu, you know, kind of warning people. Isn't that good for Rouhani's credibility inside the country, or does it really make that much of an impact?
I see what you mean, actually, Matt. You're right. Yeah, well, I can see. I wouldn't expect Netanyahu to send Hassan Rouhani a bottle of Manischewitz wine, kosher wine, to congratulate him on his recent achievement. If anything, a Manischewitz, the taste of it could be interpreted as an insult. But in any case, but still, he could have said, you know, that we hear the voice of the people of Iran. This is a step in the right direction. This is the departure of somebody who's denied the Holocaust and called for Israel's destruction. And, you know, with somebody who's more moderate. And we appreciate the choice of the people of Iran.
Yeah,
I think he could have said that. But, yes, I don't think any Israeli politician should go ahead and should go ahead and praise him. I think, if anything, if we want the nuclear – if Rouhani starts – making gestures towards the IAEA and is taking steps, I think the best thing we in Israel could help him, our politicians, is to keep on lambasting him at home. With the conservatives, I think that would be a welcome boost.
So here's the thing. We had the Supreme Leader congratulating Rouhani. We had the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, now saying that they are prepared to work with him and support his presidency. Is this real, or given what you said about the divisions at the top of the Iranian regime, should we expect to see more hawkish factions begin immediately to try and undermine him? What should we expect?
Let's look at history. I think that could give us one guide. Mr. Khatami was elected, and as soon as he wanted to improve human rights in Iran and improve relations with the West, they just made life impossible for him almost. I mean, the conservatives saw that he's improving relations with the West, and what's the best way to karate kick him? Arrest 13 Jews in Iran, which is why they did it. The reason why they arrested 13 Jews in Iran was domestic, and they wanted to basically stonewall President Khatami's rapprochement. Mm-hmm. Now, with Rouhani, I think because of the economic pressures in Iran, I think he could be given a wider mandate to improve relations because, you know, unlike the time of Khatami, Iran is not selling oil in the same way as it was. the economic situation is much more dire, which means it's more difficult for the conservatives to try to block him, because it will come out of their own pockets. However, my concern is that Rouhani will just be used to remove sanctions. I mean, Rouhani is much more than that. You know, he talked about transparency in Iran's politics. He talks about women's rights in Iran. He talks about everybody having equal opportunities. And I genuinely believe he wants to make Iran a better place. But my concern is that, you know, they're just going to use him to remove the sanctions, improve relations, and then once they're earning the big bucks again, they'll just remove him and sideline him the same way they did with other moderates and conservatives. Right. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think that on the 14th of June, the day of elections, Ayatollah Khamenei woke up and decided to be a Democrat. Yeah. Or that he decides, oh, from today I'm going to improve the rights of women in Iran, and Rouhani is the way. Sorry for being a pessimist, I just don't see it.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's just kind of, you know, based on the evidence. I would tend to agree with that. But going back to what you said about, you know, given the dire straits that the Iranian economy is in right now, that this might give Rouhani more latitude than Khatami had. I mean, that goes back to my question about whether international sanctions, which have contributed to those economic difficulties, can be credited in any way. And I mean, I speak as someone who is very, very skeptical of the ability of sanctions to kind of create a better outcome.
I think inadvertently, yes. I mean, inadvertently, they've provided Rouhani with a leverage. I think Mr. Rouhani, next time he goes to meet with the Supreme Leader and he wants to talk about the IAEA and, you know, wants to convince him, he can use the sanctions as leverage. He could say, look, we either improve relations, or if you just want to portray me as a toothless politician, then fine, you deal with the sanctions, you deal with the fallouts. But if you want me to solve the issue of the sanctions, you're going to have to give me some mandate. You're going to have to give me, you know, allow me to improve relations with the IAEA. And he is really capable of doing that. I mean, when he was negotiating with the EU3, he was very capable of actually creating a gap between the Europeans and Americans. He had the Europeans on his side. According to his own election interview, he said, you know, the Europeans even went as far as promising that they would veto any UN resolutions against Iran. You know, this is very capable, very professional diplomatic work. And I think he could use the sanctions as leverage in order to actually get some proper authority and mandate to bring about change.
So getting back to the, you know, what you said about Rouhani's ability to kind of divide the different members of the P5 plus one. What do you think the appropriate approach here on the part of the P5 plus one should be, and particularly with the United States? I mean, what do you think about the administration's reaction? Both the White House and Secretary Kerry made statements. Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough appeared on TV yesterday, you know, making, you know, the same thing, congratulating the Iranian people, but then saying Iran must live up to its obligations. What do you think of the reaction thus far from the U.S.?
I think the reaction's been good. I think it's important to congratulate President Rouhani. I think it's important to congratulate the people of Iran. I think what was particularly good, and I wish our prime minister would have done it, although he's in a different position, he can't, is that you guys in America said that, you know, we call for bilateral talks. We call for direct diplomacy with Iran as soon as he was elected. I think that's very smart. I would say, you know, don't impose any sanctions, for God's sake, right now. Let him come in. I mean, unless there's some report that says, again, Iran is stonewalling the IAEA or something, you know, let's not just impose sanctions for the sake of imposing them. This has to be part of an action-reaction process. That, you know, that it can be used in Tehran to weaken the hand of the hardliners. You know, if Ayatollah Khamenei decides, okay, I'm going to stonewall the IAEA, so the IAEA turns up in Tehran, they leave with nothing, then you could say, okay, now because Iran's not doing anything, you can impose, I don't know, some sanctions against some nuclear officials, just as an example. But if you just do it without Iran doing anything, right now especially, I think you could make the situation more difficult. But again, you know, I think the best way to go forward with this is IAEA, to be honest with you. I think the international community should get behind the IAEA, United States especially, and to basically say, you know, we have a roadmap with Iran to go forward. We have a concrete set of steps. We want Iran to have nuclear energy. We recognize Iran's right to have nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. We recognize Iran's right to have enriched uranium for limited purposes. It's something actually I hear more and more in Israel from some academics. I even heard it from Yadlin, who's the head of the INSS here in Israel.
Right.
You know, we're willing to go there, but we need to work together with Iran, and we'd welcome Iran's cooperation. And then let's see what happens.
Right. I mean, I think... Yeah, as you said, I mean, the idea that Iran is going, however, the only way that this gets negotiated, you know, the only way it's possible is with, you know, a recognition of Iran's right to enrich. So the question is, what kind of security arrangements can we have so that, you know, that's the outcome, so that Israel is satisfied, so that the U.S. is satisfied, particularly the U.S. Congress. And that's a concern I have here, too, is that, you know, the United States Congress, I mean, one of the easiest political lifts in the United States is beating up on Iran and passing yet another package of sanctions. So, you know, what I'm hoping is that there at least be, you know, a period of time here where the hawks in the Congress are willing to kind of just hold off and give it time before, you know, piling on yet another package of, you know, whatever they can come up with. You know, because one of the problems that we've seen over the past years is, you know, certainly there are disagreements here, I mean, to say the very least, between the U.S. and Iran. But there's just this, and this is not just true of the U.S. and Iran, it's true, I think, of a lot of situations you can find, is that, you know, the hawks in Iran and the hawks in the United States have this very, very strange way of absolutely confirming the each other's worldview, if you know what I'm saying. So, I mean, we saw this, you know, on, you know, the axis of evil speech, which we know from, you know, Iranian moderates themselves have said that was a disaster for us, that completely affirmed Iranian hardliners' worst assumptions about the United States. So I think the question is, can U.S. leaders, particularly in the Congress, kind of treat this with a bit of with more delicacy than they've shown thus far?
That's all. We all live in hope, Matt.
Yeah.
I have to, you know, there are people who are doing this, imposing these sanctions in the name of helping Israel, and I can appreciate that, and I can understand their sentiments. But what I think they should be noted between, you know, AIPAC especially, and anybody else in the Congress who is backing sanctions, is that, you know, now we had Ahmadinejad. Now we have the anti-Ahmadinejad in the office of the presidency in Iran. Nobody's saying that all of a sudden, you know, everything's resolved with Iran. No, you know, Iran's recognition of Iran's right to enrichment is incumbent upon Iran proving its nuclear program is for civilian purposes only. You know, once that's been proven with the IAEA, then yes, you know, we're going to recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium and hopefully even help them. You know, Iran needs help for production of medical isotopes and other stuff. But, you know, in terms of what we do right now, I think it's important to continue with what we're doing, get Iran to cooperate with the IAEA, but also realize that there is a new dynamic in Iran now. There's a new dynamic, which means that we have to be more measured. And I also think, you know, in Israel, it's the same, Matt. You know, instead of just telling you guys what you should do, I'd like to speak to my own politicians. Mm. And, you know, in Iran now, they have somebody who's much more moderate as president. No, he does not have the last say over Iran's nuclear program. He doesn't. Mm. But he's a moderate, and in Israel, just threatening Iran with all options on the table is no longer going to be viable, because Ahmadinejad is no longer in office. We have to speak in a new language, the new narrative towards the new Iran that we're looking at, because otherwise Israel is going to look like the warmongering extremist, and Iran is going to be the one who actually looks like reconciliatory and moderate, right, and who wants to reach a deal with the West. So I think, you know, in Israel, you know, despite the fact that nobody wants this regime to have nuclear weapons, I think the government should adopt its line, should change from one that's just based on pure threats to one that actually sounds that is also interested and supporting the diplomatic process. And you should also speak in a language that, you know, speaks to the people of Iran. And again, I have to say President Peres seems to have some good Iran advisors because he did a good job yesterday. Whether our prime minister's advisor is his wife on Iran, I don't know. I don't know, to be honest with you. But, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I know he's doing his job, whatever. He has to secure Israel. That's good. But, you know, you can't speak in a language that, you know, only applies to Israelis. Yes, Israelis like to sound tough. To other Israelis, it works, and I can appreciate that. But, you know, our Prime Minister is not talking to other Israelis. He's talking to other Iranians who voted a moderate. And I think it's important that we change that narrative, and that could actually boost Israel's position in the international community as a member of the consensus that's being built to stop a nuclear Iran.
All right. Well, I really appreciate this. Thanks for taking the time today. I think that brings us to a close. I guess, I mean, if you have a few more minutes, one thing I just wanted to spend a minute on before we quit is the claim, if we could just turn to Syria for a second. And there was a report in the New York or the Washington Post last week about how, you know, Iran is winning in Syria because, you know, the Assad regime has kind of taken the initiative against the rebels. And that didn't seem quite right to me. I mean, I think, yes, Iran has been a big backer of Assad. He is a key ally for them. He's an important bridge into the Arab world. But it seems to me that when sectarianism is heightened, this is a negative thing for Iran. Iran works hard to kind of overcome the Shia-Sunni divide. So certainly they value partners wherever they can get them. But to the extent that, you know, sectarian violence and sectarian grievance and resentment has become heightened as a result of Syria, that seems like a serious cost for Iran. Would you agree?
It is, and I think it's going to haunt Iran's position in the regime for decades. Because as far as many Sunni countries in this region are concerned, Iran is co-sponsoring one of the biggest massacres of their kin in this region in recent history. However, I think it's always important to note that Iran tries to always back more than two horses, and it's not always based on religion. We saw in the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which is a Shiite country over Nagorno-Karabakh, Iran supported Armenia's position. And against another Shiite country.
Yeah.
You know, for Iran, the first and foremost interest is geopolitical. And, you know, if they can work with Sunnis, they'll work with Sunnis and Shiites. But in this case, it's Bashar al-Assad, and he's the one who's working with them. And, you know, he's the one who's closest to them. For geopolitical reasons, especially, I think if Bashar al-Assad was a Sunni and the other guys were Alawites, I wouldn't put it past Iran to support him regardless. Because of the geopolitical support that he's given to them. Look, Bashar al-Assad is not a particularly religious man. Some Alawites, you know, although there are relations, not all Shiites consider Alawites, again, I'm not a religion expert, but, you know, some people see them as, you know, 3 or 4 degrees of separation between them.
Right.
For Iran, it's the geopolitical interest here. And yes, it's one which has inadvertently gotten Iran involved in a sectarian war. And we see, and this is something that is going to be a liability for Iran. But if you look at it from the Iranian side, from their own geopolitical interests, what are the choices do they have? If they let Assad go, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
And actually what happens in Syria is putting Iran and Israel inadvertently in the same camp because both don't want Assad to fall.
You think that's true of Israel? They want Assad to stay?
No. They would rather Assad go, somebody who comes into Syria, who's a moderate, who believes in democracy, and who is going to want to establish relations with Israel. The Al-Qaeda, unfortunately, reality is not like that, because there's no such person right now. We have.
All right, so you're saying, like, given the realistic available options.
Correct. I mean, believe you me, Matt, you know, when it comes to fighting extremist Shiites versus extremist Sunni Al-Qaeda, Israel would pick extremist Shiites any day. And you can't. And Hezbollah is not like Al Qaeda. As much as they are enemy of Israel,
yeah.
They are not like Al Qaeda. A chemical weapon in the hand of Hezbollah, I don't see them using against Israel because they're also a political party. Yeah. They've got their own geopolitical considerations. And a chemical weapon in the hand of Al Qaeda, Jubrat al Nasr in Syria, may the Lord have mercy on us.
Yeah. All right. On that pleasant note, we'll bring this to a close. Meir, always great talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And great speaking with you as well. Thank you.
All right, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.